You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Send in your nominations now for the APN Awards. The APN Awards celebrate the best in archaeology, heritage, history, anthropology, museum, and cultural podcasts from around the world. Open to independent, academic, institutional, and network-produced shows, the awards recognize outstanding storytelling, research communication, production, hosting, and more. Award categories include Podcast of the Year, Best Educational Podcast, Best New Podcast, Best Interview, Best Storytelling Episode, Best Host, and several fun APN-only awards for those shows hosted on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Send in your nominations before the 1st of August 2026. Public voting will then be open from the 1st of September to the 1st of October 2026, and then will culminate in a live awards show on the International Day of Archaeology, so October 17th, 2026. Find out all information and send in your nominations through the Archaeology Podcast Network website.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 335.
On today's show, we talk about a Mayan astronomer, land reduction of national monuments in the U.S., and shocking signs in front of a Smithsonian Museum.
Let's dig a little deeper, and I think I'm going to make an executive order that we do better on this show and we get more listeners.
Okay, do it.
Welcome to the show, everyone.
Hello.
All right. Well, we've got really one news article for you and two other articles that are referencing news items. We'll get to that later. Mm-hmm. But the first one is really cool, and it's about identifying a person's name, which we always talk about how one of the cool things about archaeology is seeing the moment in time, right? The moment of a real person's life in time. And we often don't get to see the names of people that did things in the past.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So this article is called, well, actually, we have a couple articles that we're linking to, because the first one we found is a National Geographic article, and I believe it's behind a paywall unless you have Apple News or National Geographic subscription or whatever. So there are a couple of choices there, but one of them is called Meet Sacton Wax. Wax? Wax.
Ox, wax. Who knows?
Sacton Wax. Because I don't want to call him Wax. A Maya math whiz who lived more than 1,000 years ago and left behind a really elegant, complex formula.
Yeah.
And now this comes from the Mayan city of Xulan in Guatemala. And basically exactly what I just said, that his name is Sacton Wax and it means roughly white-chested fox.
And I think we should start taking silver foxes and changing them to white-chested fox. You know, like an old man with silver hair. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's also probably a white-chested fox.
Well, they say at one point in the article that it's like kind of like the gray beard thing, right?
Oh, yeah,
or white beard, you know, like it's an old dude who's been doing science stuff forever and ever. And like, that's his name because he's old.
Right. And he lives in, you know, a nice area, probably goes around shirtless all the time and has a hairy chest.
Yeah.
That is white hair.
Yeah. Well, it could be.
What was his name when he was younger?
Right. Yeah.
So, all right. The discovery is made in a structure called 10K-2. And it's a small room interpreted as an astronomer's or scribe's workspace.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to start disagreeing with some things here.
Did they say what the overall area was, though? Like, is it part of a temple? Is it part of a house? I don't remember catching that anywhere in the article.
I don't think, not in this one, I don't think. We haven't seen the antiquity article.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
because I would be interested in that, too, probably for the same reasons why you have some questions here, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
The researchers found 11 hieroglyphs containing his name alongside more than 50 mathematical, quote unquote, microtexts, which are painted and etched on the walls.
Yeah. The equations concern the movements of Venus and Mars, making this the first known example of Maya astronomical calculations attributed to a specific individual. We know that the Maya had some pretty complex math.
Yeah.
And that they were charting the movements of planets and stars and things like that. And it just would have been super cool to, I don't know, put them together with a Western mathematician or something at some point and just compare notes.
Yeah, right.
All we have is hieroglyphs that are difficult to read and their equations, which aren't written in the same way that, you know, we understand them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just would have been neat to know what they were doing.
And it makes sense that a person was doing this or a group of people, because these are complex. It's probably stuff that like even people today who lay people today wouldn't be able to understand. So he would have been specialized, and it just makes sense that there's one person who was very specialized in doing these kind of calculations, knowing the movements of Mars and Venus and doing whatever it is that they did with that. They had so many structures that were constructed around when different planets were here or there, the moon, the sun, the whatever. So they had to have people who specialized in knowing about the movements of these things in order to do that kind of building, basically.
Yeah. It is cool, too. If you want to know more about the math, click into the Antiquity article, because you can go into it and look. And there's a table. In fact, table one in the article is a description of the variables, basically, and what they mean, and some of the, not necessarily just the variables, but a description of the glyphs and the things that were found on this particular wall and in this particular room. And then they do discuss the actual formula just after that. So it's a lot. It's a little dense because it's a, you know, journal article.
Oh, they always are. And of course, an archaeoastronomy journal article is going to be incredibly dense. Makes sense.
Yeah. Let me just read one portion of the text that is somewhat referring to the formula here. 4 Akbal, then 1 score days hence to 11 Akbal, 6 packs, then 13 score days to 11 Akbal, 1 zak.
What?
Obviously, that is referring.
What?
So honestly, what this is doing, and I'm not going to pretend to know a whole lot about it, but this is referencing Mars and Venus and their positions in the Mayan calendar. And those are positions on the Mayan calendar, because it's got like these circles coming out.
Yeah.
And all those have names. And then the different positions on the circles have names.
Right.
And numbers. Yeah. It's a really well done system. So
very cool. Yeah. So complicated. And so, I mean, I feel like it can provide researchers like just information for days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's really cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. This discovery humanizes Maya science by connecting, as I said earlier, sophisticated mathematical work to a named person rather than an anonymous tradition or just something you found on a wall, right?
Yeah, I think that's my favorite part of this. It's kind of what I was trying to get at earlier, is that, like, of course there's people behind this. There has to be really smart people behind it. So to have a name just makes it really cool. And that's my favorite part.
Yeah, the article says that the scholars, well, in the Antiquity article, actually say that this compares the significance of identifying Sakton Wax to knowing the names of figures like Pythagoras, Galileo, and Newton. And I'm like, does it? Like, he's got one wall with a couple of really solid equations on there, which, let's be honest, may or may not be his. He may be just the guy that was charged with drawing them on there, because do you know any mathematicians that are like super awesome artists and can do stuff on a wall?
Right.
They could have hired somebody to do that. And maybe that was the artist or the scribe's signature for putting that stuff on there. We don't know that this guy was a mathematician. We have no idea.
I hear you.
We sign stuff. Do they sign stuff?
The artist is not going to take credit for the mathematician's work, though. He's going to sign. The artist is going to put the mathematician's name on it.
We don't even know that's what this is. That's my point. We're trying to apply what we would think in our culture to the Maya 1500 years ago.
Yeah,
right? It just doesn't work.
That's fair. I mean, it definitely makes you think, like, would they have thought about attributing these equations or art, as we're calling it? They might not have called it art, but would they have attributed it the same way? I guess we don't know. We don't have that information, but I don't know. Yeah. There's a lot of work that went into those equations, and it makes more sense to me that it would be the person who was responsible for them. Whether he did it himself or he had interns, for lack of a better word, who were doing it, students, whatever.
You have to look at the overall culture as well, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even working for a company these days, you usually sign something that says whatever you produce is owned by the company.
Yeah.
Whatever you do, whatever you invent, whatever you create is owned by the company, because you created it under their permission and supplies, right? Well, I mean, a lot of monarchies, dictatorships, which is exactly what this place was, are the same way. Everything is done in service of the monarch. Everything is done in service of a god. Everything is done in service of a this or a that. So we can't even say that the name that they found had anything to do with the math or anything here. It could have just been honoring somebody we don't know about.
It's definitely true. I feel like your argument is a little bit like putting modern ideas onto the past as well, though. Like, the modern idea is that
structure.
Well, the modern idea today is that, you know, companies own all of your intellectual property that you work for. That's very modern, right? And then monarchies in the recent past, yeah, they've taken credit for what their people are doing. But is that how it was 1500 years ago in the Mayan? So it's just,
I don't know. That's, I'm just saying it's another possibility.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. Yeah. I don't know if we know, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, because we haven't deciphered a lot of names of people in Maya hieroglyphs.
Right.
Right? And maybe this is why, mm-hmm. right? Because the ones we do know are kings and mm-hmm. rulers and high priests.
Okay, so that's a really good point, though, because like in order to get your name, to have a hieroglyph for your name,
right.
number one, and to have that be inscribed or painted onto something, that makes you a really important person.
Mm-hmm.
So I could buy that it's the mathematician himself, because he would have been very important to be spending so much time and effort on these equations that were very important to the community. I could also buy maybe that it's the artist, too, because artists would possibly have had similar importance.
Yeah.
Other people, I feel less, you know, like maybe there's somebody else who could have been just as important and had a reason to have the name on the wall next to the equations, but it's just so impossible to know without mm-hmm. knowing like their full social structure. So
yeah, for sure.
Very interesting.
Well, a little more about the archaeology. The room was accidentally discovered in 2010 when a student explored a looter's tunnel cutting through the buried structure. Talk about a student's like
dream,
right?
Oh my God. I was reading that and I was like,
That's
what I wanted to happen when I was working in South America. Like all I wanted was to discover some like secret something.
It's literally like Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excavations revealed remarkably preserved murals depicting royal scribes at work. Again, royal scribes.
Yeah, you're right.
You know?
But why don't we know about a royal named, you know, white haired fox man? Like what?
I mean, I don't, maybe we just found out.
Who knows? Maybe, yeah. Maybe. Xulon is a major classic Maya city. It's located about 25 miles northeast of Tikal, but I had never heard of it. I don't know mm-hmm. if you had it. Tikal, of course, is much more known. So yeah. I don't know why that happens sometimes. It just does with these prehistoric cities.
Right. The room dates to the late 8th century CE, so the 700s,
mm-hmm.
shortly before the broader Maya political collapse.
Mm-hmm. And they make a point of saying in the article, so we'll say it here, that collapses. Not quite the right word. It was more like the Mayan people just distributed, you know, they didn't leave or go away. They just distributed.
That's why I like they say the words political collapse, right?
Because
their political structure may have gone into, you know, collapse for lack of a better way to say that. But the people were still like, I still have a farm and some corn to grow.
Right.
So
researchers deciphered the name after they recognized a phrase that means so says. Followed by a personal signature.
Yeah.
So blah, blah, blah. Says, you know, so says blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yeah.
Like, so it had to be a person.
How do they know it didn't say, so say we all?
I knew you were going to say
all
that.
This has happened before. And all of it's going to happen again.
Somebody's been rewatching Battlestar Galactica. Let's move on.
Oh, it's done.
Let's move on.
So in Battlestar, they go back 150,000 years.
Uh-huh.
And there's, you know, upright humans with stone tools and spears.
20 year spoiler.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
You just like spoiled the whole show for people.
That's great.
It's not revealed until the final episode.
Second to last episode. Yeah.
You're the worst.
Anyway.
Great show. You should watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the math that was on the wall is depicting a calculation that calculates the cycles combining Venus and Mars, including a 2,920-day cycle corresponding to 5 Venus cycles and date to AD 781. The inscriptions consist almost entirely of mathematics rather than historical narrative, highlighting the advanced computational work of Maya scholars, or at least this dude.
And it's why they think this room is some kind of scholar math cave, right? Like they, that's where they were doing all the math things.
Wow. I hope there's a bar in near MIT that's just called the math cave.
The math cave. That's a good one.
Yeah. I don't think anybody goes there because they're all studying. They're all just nerds.
Yeah.
All right. My astronomy was deeply connected to religion, of course. Calendar systems. They had some of the most advanced calendar systems on the planet.
As we know, 2012.
I know. Well, I guess they weren't that advanced.
Yeah. They didn't say the world was ending. It was just that their calendar ended. Come on.
Which I think implies the world is going to end.
Well, turns out it didn't.
Yeah. I think the world's going to end every year. And then that January that rolls around, that new calendar shows up.
It's like you don't know what's coming after it. Who knows?
If your brother didn't give me a calendar with cats on it every Christmas, I think.
Sometimes it's horses. You never know.
Oh, we actually have a house now. I'm actually looking forward to a calendar, but he hasn't done it in a while. Yeah.
No, he stopped giving calendars. Anyway, it's a family joke. My brother would go get cheap calendars and give them to everybody for Christmas.
Oh, that's so funny. All right. So the workspace was likely, and here's where the article diverges again from what I would probably say. The workspace was likely where astronomers developed calculations before copying finalized versions into bark paper codices, such as the Dresden Codex. Now, we do have stuff like that, where this is more of a difficult to produce and more permanent, I guess, record.
Yeah.
Like a codex. And yeah, sure, you would want to have your information refined prior to putting it on this thing, right? It's like etching it into stone. Like, you're not going to do that until you know what you're doing, right?
Except that they did. That what this is saying is that they did etch it into stone while they were solving it.
It was still paint, I think. It wasn't carved. So
it was both. They said that there's paintings and etchings.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
But, and that's why, again, they said in the article that this was like I guess one of the researchers was quoted as saying, this is like you're looking at literally a whiteboard in a mathematician's office, you know, and they're figuring out stuff. Now, a mathematician's whiteboard doesn't have finished calculations on it, right? It has the work it takes to get to those calculations.
Yeah.
He's partially probably right. I don't know where they would have done the work to figure all this stuff out, right? I mean, when you write the final equation, though, which is, I want to see a little more about this and understand it. Is this an example of somebody showing their work? Or do these inscriptions represent the final calculations of things? Because if that's the case, this wall is more likely just the recording of this, right? Hey, we don't want to lose this, so we're going to stick it here. And that's what it's going to be. If this were akin to a whiteboard, you would see a lot more mistakes.
The wall feels very permanent to me.
Yeah,
so I'm
what I'm saying.
And also, like, if this is going to be your place to come up with calculations, okay, fine. But, like, wall space runs out eventually. So how, I don't know. I guess how would they have managed that? Would they put another layer up after they filled one in?
No? That's what I'm saying. The analogy of this being a whiteboard is incorrect. I think this is more of a permanent record of final results.
Mm.
You know, similar to a codex. But I think this was put on the wall. It was put there maybe for other people to learn from and study, maybe as a record, maybe so they don't lose it. But I'm willing to bet that they did all their work with, you know, charcoal and some version of paper or dried tree bark or something, or even in the ground, right? Somewhere where they could have, or even paint. It could have been paint.
Yeah, where
they would paint over.
Yeah, they could paint or wipe it away. But and then once they got to a position where they're like, okay, this we want to put on the wall because this we're sure about.
Right.
I mean, so it really could be an in-between step. Like if it's like that, I like that theory a lot, actually, where they're like, you know, using dirt or paint to get their ideas going, get to a certain place, put it up on the wall, and then keep adding to that wall. And then finally they have their finished whatever at the end of that. And that's when they start transferring it to the, what kind of material did they say? Bark paper, the bark paper codices. Like that actually kind of does make sense because they do need a template or a hard copy that can't be changed or ruined. So yeah, less of a whiteboard and more of a final copy, right?
Yeah, and I didn't see anywhere in here where, I mean, they were using spectral analysis and de-stretch and things like that to really pull out some of the images. And I didn't see in here where it seemed like there were multiple layers going on here. Right?
No, I didn't. I didn't see any of that now, get talked about.
I guess they could have put something else on there and then, I don't know how this stuff comes off, you know, sanded off in some way. Or something to start over, right, with a new surface.
Possible.
But I don't really know.
They might have had a way to remove it when they needed clean space again.
They were a relatively advanced society. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like a final destination for these things and not a work in progress.
Yeah.
You know?
Like a, hey, Joe student, I need a copy of the Mars-Venus calculation from, you know.
Could you run down to the basement?
2 years ago. Can you run down and copy that onto some bark for me? Thanks. Bye. See you in a week because that'll take a while.
Yeah.
I hope you've got some good artistic skills too.
First I have to go find the trees. I've got to dry and flatten the bark. Listen, I've got to make a pencil out of charcoal.
We're like making a joke out of this, but good Lord, how hard is all of that to do for this society? So this stuff clearly was so important to them.
Didn't they just shop at the Amazon?
Oh, dude, wrong continent.
But it's close enough. I mean, free shipping. All right. Well, now we're going to move on to a couple of articles that are going to be disturbing, distressing, and make you want to move. So we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 335 of the Archaeology Show. The next two articles are very much in the same vein and they're upsetting, but I feel like we need to talk about them. So
Yes. And if you happen to not be of the more liberal persuasion, please stick around and listen, because like these things are important to talk about no matter what side of the political spectrum you are on.
All right. So this article is from the Salt Lake Tribune in Utah. So Salt Lake City, Utah.
Yep.
President Trump drastically shrinks two Utah national monuments again.
Again.
Yes. So he cut nearly 3 million acres across Grand Staircase, Escalante, and Bears Ears. And again, these are both national monuments in, I believe, southern Utah.
I know Escalante's in southern Utah because we've been there. Yeah. We rode on four wheelers into the back of it. Remember? That was super fun when we were camping for a project out there eons ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. So the, let's see, Grand Staircase Escalante had 1.69 million acres cut from it.
Mm-hmm.
And Bears Ears had 1.24 million acres cut from it. And that's about 90% of the lands previously protected in each monument.
That is crazy. That is so much land that's just all of a sudden not protected.
Yeah.
But we got to talk about what that exactly means, though. It doesn't mean that they are going to like carve it up and start selling it to people to build, you know, subdivisions on, right?
Well, not right away.
Not right away. The immediate reason for doing it seems to be that these lands are now open to mining, drilling, and geothermal leasing for copper, zinc, and uranium. So this is a materials grab, basically, to see what they can get from this land.
Yeah, it's part of the Trump administration and overall Republican, I guess, agenda to bring more things back to the United States, bring manufacturing, bring, you know, resources and all that sort of stuff. But so in order to do that, we need to have the land that we know the things are on allow us to get to those things. I mean, that's the pure argument there.
Like,
right?
Precious metals are super important and anywhere we can pull them out of our own land means we don't have to buy them from somewhere else. And
even though we can probably still get them from somewhere else a lot cheaper, even shipping them over here, because labor's cheaper.
Yeah.
Now there are some practices in other countries. And in fact, just another news item here, in case you're not paying attention to all this stuff, I think it was like 50 different countries or maybe 60 countries just in the last week or so. And we're recording this on the end of July, 2026. They threw some pretty heavy tariffs on them. And I would kind of somewhat agree with this if it's true overall, but it's because of labor practices.
Yeah.
Child labor, not child labor, but what do they call it?
Just underpaid.
It's like slave labor.
Yeah.
Like people literally working for nothing except their lives.
Yeah.
Right? So a lot of countries were hit with this because they don't have proper protections. And that is something you deal with a lot of these minerals, because a lot of them come from Africa. And let's be honest, they don't have the best working practices down there a lot of times. So
I think protecting the workers is important. Yeah. And if the countries won't do it themselves, then stuff like that, tariffs like that, can help do it.
Yeah.
I'm just speaking off the cuff. I haven't actually done any research into that. So don't come for me if there's more there that I don't know about. But
yeah, we'll get more to, well, at least my thoughts on why I don't think that really matters all that much here as far as this land goes. But some more things that this executive order does is it disbands the Bears Ears Commission, which eliminates formal tribal co-stewardship. So there's a Bears Ears Commission of tribal leaders that would help manage this resource, because Bears Ears was made a national monument largely because of the importance to the local tribal communities.
Right.
Right. So.
And it was... it's most recent. It was the one that Barack Obama did when he was president.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. And then Trump in his first term reduced it.
Yes.
And now his second term, he's reduced it even more.
Yeah. In 2016, December 28th, 2016, it was declared a monument. It's largely undeveloped land and it contains a lot of historic, cultural, natural resources. So it was super important to the native groups in the area. So
yeah, tribal leaders, of course, criticized the decision for lacking consultation because nobody talked to them about it, and disrespecting sacred ancestral homelands, while Utah officials, including their governor, Spencer Cox, welcomed the decision as a long overdue right-sizing.
And this is all just like a Republican-Democratic pissing match, because like if you look at the history of Bears Ears in particular, it was made a monument at the end of 2016 by President Obama. A year later, in December of 2017, President Trump in his first term reduced it, right?
Yeah.
And then in October of 2021, President Biden restored all of the territory that Trump removed.
Yeah.
And now it's again been cut by Trump. Like, what are we going to do? Just go back and forth and back and forth? And like, It's just such a disregard for the people who have stewarded this land for so long. And also, how does a mining company, what mining company in their right mind would even get involved in this? Knowing that if the administration changes political parties next term, there's a dang good chance that it's just going to get, you know, restored again.
Well,
it's,
and that's
stupid.
That's what I'd like to know, too. Like, was there exploratory mining? Because the process of mining actually includes many years of going in. Doing not only exploratory mining, but like, you know, different methods for determining what's underground. Right. Yeah. So they got to know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
During that time when it was reduced, did any mining companies actually go in there?
Did they start,
start making claims?
Yeah.
And start making work. Yeah.
And then they had to stop for the last 5 years while it was protected again from 2021 till now. And now they can go back in again. I mean, it's entirely possible that some really good lobbyists got to the Trump administration and made this happen so that the company that they're lobbying for can can continue with whatever mining they were planning on doing or had started doing. So it's so gross. Well, all of it. When you start thinking about it,
there's environmental groups, including the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, that plan to sue, arguing that the Antiquities Act does not permit the shrinking of monuments. So while the president can create monuments pretty much at will, I mean, usually they wouldn't do it unless somebody comes to him with a bunch of information and, you know, really well thought out plan. But apparently the president's power, according to these legal arguments, is that they can't take them away. They can't reduce them. There's a process around it, obviously.
Yeah.
But the president can't just do it with an executive order.
Yeah.
The Trump administration is saying they can.
Of course, they do everything by executive order. They just say that we're going to do it and then hope for the best.
Yeah.
But I wonder if this group also, you know, sued or planned to sue back when it was first reduced for Bears Ears specifically.
Yeah.
And what came of that? I didn't think to do that research because this is all just sort of coming up as we're having this conversation. But yeah, I don't know.
Here's one of the things that really gets me too. Proponents and motorized recreation groups celebrated the orders, claiming they restore public access to closed off areas, whereas local guides are saying that activities like hunting, fishing and hiking were already allowed. You know,
it's still,
and it's a national monument, but that's often allowed on those types of lands anyway.
Yeah, a lot of that is allowed. Now, they do control motorized vehicle access on certain parts of it. But I'm thinking again about Escalante, where we were on a road, gravel road, back road, gravel, dirt road. And we just rode right in to the national monument area. And there was no sign saying that we couldn't. And there was no gate and nothing stopping us on four wheelers, which can be pretty destructive. So I don't know what kind of closed off areas are talking about, but again, I haven't looked into that specifically. Maybe there were, who knows.
Well, it's interesting to me because 3 million acres in the grand scheme of things is not really that much land when
not
you're talking about places for you to go.
Yeah,
let me just do a quick Google search here. How much public land does Utah have right now in acres? Okay, about 35 million acres, which is less than
I thought.
It's
a lot less than I would have expected.
Yeah, there's a lot of ranch land, I think, things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It said the BLM has about 22.8 million acres, which is 65% of all federal land in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
Forest Service has about 8 million. National Park Service has about 2.1 million. I don't know if that's been updated.
Well, does the National Monument count as part of National Park Service? Because the parks are like Bryce Canyon and Zion.
Sure.
They might be separate from the national monuments. I'm not sure how.
Yeah, they may share management between the Forest Service and the BLM. Yeah, I'm not sure about
the
national monuments.
Differently.
Yeah. And then the Department of Defense has 1.8 million acres. Mm. That's just military bases and things.
Yeah.
And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has about 108,000 acres. That's nothing.
Yeah. Interesting.
There's 5.4 million acres of state public land as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Total public land in Utah is about 40 million acres. And I got to say, we've been all over Utah. We've been in backcountry Utah. We've been all over the place. And there are plenty of places to take your four-wheelers.
There's plenty of places.
You don't have to go here. Why aren't these groups complaining that they can't take their four-wheelers out on Zion National Park?
Right. Well, they probably are.
Well, they probably are. Yeah.
Because they'll complain about anything anywhere, right?
Yeah.
No, I think that's a ridiculous argument that you don't need that little bit of land. So,
well, like you said, this is purely political, really.
It's just a resources grab or a hope for a resources grab.
Yeah.
The one thing I'll say is that if it's mining that's going to be happening primarily on this land, it's subject to federal regulations as they are right now,
mm-hmm.
which means they have to get permits. They have to follow all of the various different rules. And in order to do that, they have to protect both the, they have to protect the land. They have to,
well,
not protect, but what's the right, what's the word I'm looking for? They have to.
There's certain conservation efforts that have to be done.
But, yeah. From both animals, plants, flora, fauna, sure. and cultural. Like they have to do all that.
But the Trump administration is trying to get rid of most of that.
Well, they're trying to, but they haven't yet.
To remove the red tape.
I know. Yeah. I know.
So,
and
there's big changes coming to Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act, which would eliminate a lot of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we should probably talk about that once. yeah. Maybe we'll have some of the CRM Mark mm-hmm. people on to have a conversation. But anyway, yeah. So at least there's that. I'm just thinking about our experience working with mining companies in mm-hmm. Nevada when we were doing resource cultural resource management. And yeah. depending on the mining company, of course, a lot of them were very interested in working with the tribes and making sure that they were following the regulations and doing the work that needed to be done before they were digging in certain places.
Yeah.
Not all the time. Like I definitely saw a road get blown through an area that they weren't supposed to do. So like, it, yeah. you know, it doesn't happen all the time, but they do at least have these regulations that they have to follow in order to get their permits. Right. So, yeah.
Indeed.
That's, I don't know if that's like a silver lining or like a, it's yeah. a lining. It's like a, I don't know.
There's a lining.
It's a lining. It's just
worth
not,
the lining
it's
of
not
a trash
very
can,
bright.
I think. But, all right. Well, speaking of trash cans, it doesn't get any better than this on the other side of the break. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 335 of the Archaeology Show. And this next article is no better than the last one. Yeah,
it's really not. It's really yeah. not. It's almost worse, honestly.
Yeah,
because that last one, like I said, change of administration and we might see all that land come right back.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, well, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, this is called, well, the one, it's all over the place. But Trump orders signage warning visitors of inaccurate information at the Smithsonian. I got this just from NBC News. So essentially, through executive order, again, and this is actually an executive order from a few months ago, but then elaborated on, Trump ordered that warning signs be placed outside the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, a place we've
ridiculous.
Been in on the Washington Mall, on the mm-hmm. wall in Washington, D.C.,
yep.
and signs warning visitors about inaccurate information inside and directing them to alternative historical resources.
So ridiculous yeah. and upsetting. I just can't stop thinking about the probably millions of school children that are going to move through these museums for the rest of the term yeah. while these are going to be up and read that absolute utter nonsense.
Apparently on July 4th, the White House had a report that claimed that the museum fails to tell America's story honestly or in an inspiring way. And Trump accuses the Smithsonian leadership of using history to push social justice and divisive narratives rather than a shared national heritage. Now, I don't know what to tell you, but history is messy, right? And the
it
Smithsonian,
is.
From my view of it, when we went through a number of the Smithsonian mm-hmm. museums, including this one.
Yeah.
And I mean, they put stuff up that had an impact on history, good or bad.
Yeah.
You know, and these are things that are generally probably recognizable by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it's just it's part of our story, whether you like it or not. You know,
I wonder if these signs are specifying anything in particular. Sounds like probably not.
Well, it said they're directing people to specific
to
resources.
Other resources. Yeah.
yeah. What are those resources?
Yeah. What are those?
You know,
resources?
The Trump Library. I mean, what's in there?
Yeah. Because like I'm trying to think like what is in there that they would disagree with and probably like something about colonialism and the treatment of Native Americans. That would be something I would see they would disagree with. Probably slavery as well.
Yeah.
Anything that doesn't make the white colonizers look good. Right.
Yeah.
Because that's who's running our country right now is the white colonizers for the most part. So or the descendants of them anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's just it's so frustrating because you can't brush that under the rug and pretend like it didn't happen or try to, you know, whitewash it and make it look better than it was. It happened. It is what it is. And we have to accept our past and just try to move forward better and be better moving forward. And if you tell people, especially young people going in to learn about all this information that, oh, by the way, like this might all be wrong and you should go learn an alternative history here. Not only is that wrong, it's like it's just confusing too.
Yeah.
It's just confusing for them. Why yeah. would we teach kids that? Oh,
yeah.
Nah.
It's
hate.
Strikes me as odd, too, that they're putting it on the outside of the museum, not just like on the inside, because I don't know if he has any control over the
probably
inside.
Probably have no control over the inside. Yeah, they run as independent entities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find out if any of these signs have actually been put up yet.
Yeah. Are there like pictures of them?
I don't see any pictures yet. I'm trying to find something. Yeah. There's just a bunch of people making AI pictures. Uh-huh. But I don't see anything that says anything. Anyway,
so one could hope that this is another like empty promise or empty threat from the current administration and that it won't actually happen.
Yeah.
One could hope.
Well, anyway, it's crazy. And I think we shouldn't be afraid of our history, honestly. Yeah. It makes us who we are. And again, good or bad, it's there. And the whole point of a museum, in my opinion, is to learn from history, you know, learn what happened in the past. And maybe if there's mistakes, there's been pluses, there's been minuses, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think people would see it as a good thing that we rebelled against the government, the government of England specifically, and started our own country.
Yeah.
Although today, if you mention rebelling against the government, that's a bad thing. But hey, when the government starts being shitty, you rebel against it.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, that's what this country was founded on.
And you're only revolutionary until you win, and then you're the victors and you get to write the history any way you want.
But... yeah. Or you're hanged for treason. Yeah. It's only one of two ways. That,
or you lose and status quo, go back to status quo.
Yeah.
But
so that reminds me, you have to watch the last season of Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, yeah. Does that remind you of that? That's
100% great. That reminds me of that.
That's great. That's where your brain goes.
Yeah. So that is where we're headed, basically.
That's a little bit, maybe a little bit dramatic. But.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so. There's so many, all these little tiny things, and this isn't even tiny, but these little things that the administration keeps doing through executive order, mind you. So no real official position whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like we're at war with Iran right now and it's undeclared. You know, it's just all these little things. And all these little things add up, though. And people are like, oh, like you just said, oh, really? Are we headed that way? It can't be that bad. It was just this one little thing. But it all just adds up.
Yeah.
It all just adds up until it tips over. And before you know it, you know, we're not making choices anymore. You know?
Well, I'm not making choices anymore.
Yeah. Well.
Exactly. You probably still get to make choices, but
You're definitely not making choices. Yeah. So anyway, don't want to end on a downer, but there it is. I'm interested to hear your guys' opinions. We have a few people that write in all the time. Mm-hmm. I know we'll probably hear from them, but I'm interested in hearing everybody else. So
yeah, for sure.
Contact info is on the show notes. Also, when you're over there at the show notes on our website, check out on the main page. I don't know where our people have put it. I think it's just right on the front page, but we have the APN Awards coming up in October.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you can nominate your favorite amongst different categories, your favorite show. It doesn't even have to be an APN show.
Favorite show, favorite host, favorite whatever.
Favorite episode.
There's APN Awards within the network for people doing the work on these shows. And then there's also like the Anybody Awards that are anybody who's doing good work.
Yeah. If our editor did her job, then there was an announcement from Tilly, our social media coordinator, at the beginning of this episode.
Yes, she definitely did her job for this show. She might have forgotten a couple earlier in the month because this has been open for a month. And yes, so there's a chance that some of the shows were missed by accident, but definitely this one got it.
Okay, good. Thanks 100%. For all that. Thanks for all that. Yeah,
no problem. But the dates are
all in
out,
there. So. Yes, the dates are all in there. I can't remember the exact dates, but the way it works is you're going to submit a nomination through our online form, and you don't have to answer all the categories, just the ones you're interested in, but submit a nomination, and then we'll take all those nominations and put them into a voting situation. So you'll vote on everything that was nominated, and then we'll announce those plus some other fun ones on National Day of Archaeology, or is it International Day of Archaeology?
October 17th. International Day of Archaeology, I'm pretty sure. So,
all right.
Yeah. So go nominate now, and then we're going to do magical background things. And then in September, go back and vote.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Man, I love having people that do magical background things. Magical background things is code for I don't have to do it. Sorry, guys.
That is your favorite way that things happen around here. Yeah.
I do actually love that.
That's true.
All right. Well, again, send us your opinions, send in your nominations for your favorite shows. And again, it doesn't have to be an APN show. I mean, obviously, APN has the best archaeology podcasts ever.
I mean, clearly. And if you're not nominating me and Chris for stuff, then why are you even doing it?
Yeah. Why are you even doing it? So
just kidding.
Yeah. Nominate this one as the most historically inaccurate show you've ever heard.
Is that a category? I hope it is.
I hope it is.
That'd be like an Ig Nobel award.
I know, right? This was mostly our opinions, by the way, this last two segments. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, clearly we yeah. have very liberal opinions on these things, but yeah.
Yeah, is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.